Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 87 featuring David Chantos from PSYOP. Dariush, you and I were just talking about PSYOP just moments ago. Tell me, what do you think about PSYOP?
I think they do really great work. They have high concept designs, and the stuff they pump out is really impressive.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about them is that unlike traditional post VFX type studios, they come up with all the creative themselves.
Yeah.
They direct it themselves. They board it. They present the actual concepts and do all the stuff themselves, which is interesting because they sometimes even go directly towards the product. So like Samsung, for example, may hire them instead of an agency that works for Samsung, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When I was a creative director at Radium and when I was souping at Brand New School, PSYOP was you could hear their name like almost on a daily basis, especially when you're bidding on jobs. They're a very powerful force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and really, really unbelievably creative. And David's been a director there for a while. He was one of the people that started the LA office. He started in the New York office and went to the LA office. So kind of an exciting guy. A few things that you can check out is one of his shorts named Sisters that he had been working on for about 6 to 8 years. It was sort of one of those back burner projects. Mm-hmm. And then when they'd get new people, they'd sort of get people to help out on it to see how they can, you know, get used to a pipeline or whatever. Really cool project. It's a music video by a song from Fever Ray, which is great. Do you know much Fever Ray?
I don't. Yeah. I'm about two generations behind in my music. Okay. I'm an old man.
Yeah, all right, yeah. It was a little after Sinatra.
he did it his way.
He did it. It's true. He's now actually completely focused on VR. He said they actually have another office in LA, and that's mainly the focus of what he's done is VR work, which is really cool. And they did their first thing. His first thing did something called Kismet, which is a VR fortune telling. Kind of interesting idea and sort of dipping their toe into that. So there'll be links on both those things. So make sure to go to labs.chaosgroup.com and go to the podcast page, and we'll have links to David's projects. So make sure to check those out. Really, really cool guy. Loved having him here. One more announcement we have this week is the website's out.
It is, and it looks fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks really great.
Fabulous. It does look really fabulous. It has huge amounts of content in it.
Yeah.
So we have this new thing called V-Ray Magazine. So it's just stories about stuff that from our customers and things that are going on, which is going to be updated very, very regularly. Once to twice a week, there'll be new content in there.
Yeah. A lot of stuff flows through.
Yeah. And the gallery is all new and super organized.
Beautiful
looks
stuff.
Looks really, really great. Highly, highly encourage people just to go to chaosgroup.com and see it. Yes, our website was slightly dated before, and we've completely redone it from scratch, and it looks really great. So please go check that out.
Yeah, we hope it's inspirational to people, and they can look at that and say, you know, I can make something like this.
And just on an information basis of just seeing cool things that are out there that our customers are doing. Because we do talk to them all the time, and it's important that we want to be able to share all that stuff. So
yeah, totally. It's a great site.
Cool. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. And hopefully you enjoy the podcast with David.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has for now.
So listen, I looked up a little bit of history about you.
Great.
Not much, because there's not as much as I'd like out there about there. But I know that you went to school in Rochester, right?
I did.
Right?
Yeah.
RIT, right?
Yes.
Okay. I know RIT. I went to school at, I went to Colgate.
Oh, okay.
So it's not far from there.
No. The cold, frigid north of Western New York is horrible. Yeah.
The snow belt.
Oh God, a horrible place.
Yeah, it's very, very cold up there. So what were you studying over there?
I was studying experimental animation and visual psychology.
Visual psychology.
Yes, which is the biology of perception, not necessarily like the psychological impact of images.
Okay.
Which is what I thought it was when I signed up for it, but then it turned out to be something entirely different, which was also very useful.
Okay. Well, give me a little bit. That's fascinating. Tell me about that.
It's really about how the brain sees and how it uses the eyes and how that all of that stuff is kind of connected. And most of the things that we were even talking about were entirely hypothetical because they still, don't understand exactly how all of that stuff kind of works. But it really was talking about, how we perceive patterns and shapes and colors and process those into images and objects and all that kind of stuff.
So it was much more biological.
It was almost entirely biological.
Interesting.
Which was very, very interesting. And most of the people who enrolled in the class had no idea that that was the purpose of, it was my minor essentially.
Right.
Had no idea. There was a bunch of artists in that class, and most of them dropped out because they couldn't really hang with the intensity of the actual science that was being taught. But I really enjoyed it, even though it wasn't what I intended either. But
that's fascinating. Yeah. Really, really, I guess it's somewhat possibly related, and maybe you can correct me about it. Mm-hmm. But we I don't always talk about. I rarely actually talk about Ray on this show. But in our new build, Vlado has been coming up with some different algorithms to sample things closer to perception rather than noise. So it adds more samples in areas where your eyes would see them.
Isn't
more.
That interesting? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Because, there's a lot of wasted samples on areas need them.
Right. Yeah, like imperceptible contrast differences and things like that, right?
So what do your eyes see in contrast? Is that some of the things like, I've seen the ideas of where you're staring at a negative image for a long time.
Right.
And then you see the
it's
positive.
It's all cell-based. And there are even specialized groups of neurons that are made to recognize specific geometric alignments of objects and patterns.
Is that the way that the cells are aligned in your eyes?
No, okay. Because that's in your brain. It's outside of your eyes. So the eyes are really only just the pixel color information.
Okay.
And then later on, all of those patterns are processed in chunks in this really fascinating way that is, it's very peculiar.
The things that scare me about eyes and is when I went to the eye doctor and and he was showing me a picture of the inside of my eye,
Which is gross,
It's gross, but it also shows you, there's two areas. There's one, obviously, where you don't have any. You have a blind spot, which is where your cortex is connected, right?
The optic nerve, exactly.
And then there's another little area, which is teeny, which is where 90% of your vision or more is.
Right,
and it's amazing. It's really scary considering that we are visual people, right? And especially us as a profession, that's like our entire job.
Yeah.
And it relies on that incredibly small area.
Right. Well, one of the most fascinating things about this visual psychology program that I was in is I learned all about these fantastic perceptual diseases, these abnormalities of the brain that shut down specific sections of perceptual stuff like prosopagnosia, which is the inability to distinguish anyone's face from any other face. You're essentially face blind. You can't recognize anyone from anyone else. It's essentially like the inability of the brain to put the face together and correlate it to a memory of an actual person.
Right.
And so everyone looks like a stranger to you and you couldn't even really identify them in a lineup if you tried.
Wow.
There's another one where
even people that you know.
That you know, unless you were to hear their voice or find some other identifying quality about them that didn't involve their face, then you'd be able to kind of assemble their image.
Wow.
It's really fascinating. There's ones that you can see in
black
and white. So I guess
that's a part of your brain that is...
It's usually like a stroke or an injury or something in a very specific part. Just the same thing with the little portion of your eye where all the good stuff is. There's a lot of little bits of good stuff that
in your
if
brain.
They're messed up, you're totally screwed.
And color blindness is another one that's interesting. It's usually color confusion is the better
Right, but achromatopsia is actually the inability to see any color whatsoever and you see in black and white.
Right.
Isn't and that's that not an happen? Eyeball thing. That's a brain thing too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, it was interesting because there is an eyeball version of that as
right,
well,
right.
which is... comes, I spoke to my eye doctor. I love actually going through to my eye doctor. He said, that's actually related to people that are albinos.
Oh, interesting. Oh, okay.
But albino is basically
pigment in the cells doesn't react.
They don't
to the
have
light
rods.
Or something. Yeah, exactly.
They
right.
only have. So oh, they don't have cones. They only have
right,
rods.
Sure, that's so bizarre.
And so they actually have huge because rods are not good at vision. Like
right,
cones
right,
are
right.
much better at sharp vision.
Right. Right.
So it's really interesting. Okay, well, fascinating. Okay, so no, it's good. How did that influence your animation, experimental
animation?
Well, it was
all kind of part of the same type of thing. And so in the experimental animation program, I had been already doing computer animation for a long time since I was a kid, actually,
okay.
Which is another story entirely. And so what I was mainly studying there was all different types of animation, from stop motion to hand-drawn to abstract animation.
Yep.
The woman who kind of ran the program there, Stephanie Maxwell, she was the type of animator that put, you know, acid on undeveloped film and burned colors and patterns into it and
sure.
arranged these, you know, kind of super abstract music-based visual experiences.
Right.
And so it was really out there stuff, and mm-hmm. it did have a lot to do with colors and patterns and shapes and frequency of images and all of this kind of thing. And it just seemed like a good kind of relationship. In the background, outside of the university, I was continuing to learn computer animation stuff and did actually a variety of things that were mixtures of computer animation, hand-drawn stuff, live action.
Yep.
Even I did a installation piece that was like a proto VR type of scenario, which was stereo image, stereo projection with a single person in a single room in a fixed position in the center with like a rumble pack that had an audio and all that kind of stuff. And so it was without goggles, but with at least 3D glasses and in a confined space, which was interesting as well.
When was this? So, yeah. Is this in the early 2000s, right?
This was, right? Yeah, I graduated in 2003. Yeah.
Okay, so very early 2000s.
Yeah, very early 2000s, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's
so this
cool.
was before HD, yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I know.
So stereo projection at that time even was dicey at 720 by 540.
And so did you have to build everything and sort of kind of make the hardware work?
The Rumble Pack came from eBay. It was an old school Super Nintendo accessory.
Nice.
Original jam.
Uh-huh.
And the glasses, the stereo glasses were the liquid crystal ones
the
that would
ones.
Oscillate the shutter glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, everything was wired and
wow.
crazy. Yeah, it was interesting.
That's cool.
It was fun. Yeah.
That's cool. And yeah. So what did you want to do when you left, that where you wanted to go into animation,
I had
feature
no
films?
Idea.
Or?
I had no idea.
Uh-huh.
It was essentially more of an art experiment, that whole process, rather than a career kind of preparatory thing.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, even working in animation outside of movie special effects was really, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of opportunities for
mm-hmm.
that. And I discovered actually PsyOps work in commercials, especially in commercials for overseas products for Europe and things like that.
Right.
That had this fantastic kind of artistic quality to them.
Yeah.
But they were, you know, making money and they were, you know, doing these things. And I thought, well, isn't that an interesting route? And that's kind of how I ended up in commercials.
Okay.
Was by, you know, I moved to New York City and just kind of wedged my way into that community as best I could, and ended up working at
PsyOp 3 years
later.
How long has PsyOp been around at that point?
PsyOp was open in 2000,
okay.
So they had been only open for a few years, and I ended up working there, I think, in 2005 or 2006.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's so. Yeah, their New York office, I'm really aware of it. It's really kind of cool. And obviously they opened an office out in LA. Now, were you one of
yes.
the first people that came out to LA?
Yes, I was. Yeah. So I worked in the New York office until March of 2008. And they sent me out here to open up this this office
with Nisa.
In Venice with Nisa.
Right.
And with a whole, not a whole group. It was, there were five of us.
Right.
You know? And I was a CG supervisor at the time. So I was supervising our first job. We had done the previs in New York, and then I came out here and built a team to do the animation, lighting, rendering, compositing.
Right.
And then it was supposed to be temporary. I was only supposed to be here for a month and a half.
Oh, really?
And that was 8 years ago.
Was it for a specific
job? Yeah. Yeah, it was for that job, yeah. Just to do the first job, do the first round of hiring, yep. And then go back to my brand new apartment that I just moved into in New York all of this stuff. And then, yeah, that was 8 years ago.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, because I remember when I went to Method, mm-hmm. And it was right after there's been sort of a split that happened at Method,
sure,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Nisa was one of the people that felt, yeah. You know, that what was going on at Method at the time. Law has changed, all everything's
right,
changed.
Of course,
because
yeah.
It's ancient history. But at the time, yeah. She's like, Gina's like, no, I'm gonna, you know, they're gonna start the PSYOP, and so mm-hmm. A lot of the people from Method, a lot of very talented people,
yeah.
Went over there,
yeah,
and I'm sure they're still there. A lot mm-hmm. of them, right?
Some of them, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a really kind of cool. And I've always been fascinated by PSYOP's work because
cool.
It is one of those. There are a few places out there that are kind of cool in the sense that they sort of take the very, very creative part of motion graphics mm-hmm. and make it into interesting animation
right,
that's 3D
right.
and photorealistic or
right,
whatever,
right,
you know,
right.
Sort of, because for a long time it was like, you do crazy cool motion graphics or you do mm-hmm. photorealistic
right,
visual effects.
Exactly, yeah.
And it
yeah.
wasn't sort of
there's
blended
room,
together.
A lot of room in between
mm-hmm.
there to play around
yeah.
in, which is the fun part, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so tell me a little bit about the philosophy behind PSYOP and how that's sort of creatively speaking.
Sure. So it was founded by all creatives, and so they were all working together at places like MTV,
gotcha.
In New York in the in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And for like Liquid Television
uh-huh.
and stuff like that. And so there's these five or six friends all kind of banded together and just started this little company, and their first office was in a bar, was an old bar, and they actually had a liquor license for the office itself because it came with the bar, which was great. And they started up and started doing things that really, you know, there hadn't been a lot of, and so most of the things that they did were really kind of new and very forward thinking, at least. And there was,
uh-huh.
you know, not a whole lot of competition in that arena. I joined on when they did the first Happiness Factory. That
okay.
was my first job, was as a texture painter on that. And that was really what kind of blew it up into a huge place, because that drew a lot of attention.
Yeah, tell people, because not everyone is going to necessarily know what the texture
what the Happiness the Factory,
Happiness Factory
is.
Yeah.
I know, which is funny because it was 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, it was.
It was,
and
it
we
wasn't
have a lot of listeners. So
yeah, that's true. It wasn't tremendously successful in the U.S. either. It was a huge international hit, but the Happiness Factory was this great Coca-Cola campaign. I think I actually did 7 of them.
Yeah, there were a lot of them
in my career.
Right?
There was a lot of them, and it was a commercial that a guy puts a quarter in a Coca-Cola machine. You follow the quarter inside the machine and discover that it's inhabited by these little blue characters, and it has this crazy, fantastic world filled with these like Rube Goldberg contraptions
right.
that essentially, you know, vend the Coke for you through this elaborate and ridiculous process
right.
Involving all these bizarre characters. And that was so much fun. It was insane.
In fact,
at
the time, it was completely out of control.
Completely.
And now it's
yeah.
actually become kind of a language
right,
that people
exactly.
use all the time.
It's true. And there's, and even, you know, for years after that, I mean, we did a whole host of different versions of that,
yep.
Including short films.
And they were big. They were like, some of them were like 2 minutes or
yeah,
more, right?
Yeah, three. We had one that was like 3.5 minutes, and it was crazy.
Right.
And people loved them, and yeah, that was a really fun thing. People would always come, clients would always come to us during that time and request a different version of the same thing for their product, you know, and it was
right.
just kind of
yeah.
hilarious. There's tons of attempts at,
it happens.
It just always happens. Yeah.
It happens. I've seen, I think Blur did a Run commercial that looks almost exactly like the opening sequence to Go With a Dragon Tattoo.
Right. Incredible. There you go. Oh, right. Well, at least it's their own kind of
right.
cannibalism. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. But so it's really kind of interesting that was going on. But you've always been while you're also a very creative person, you're also a very technical person, right? So you were able to like think pipelines, think big pictures. And that's now, did that come from what you learned at RTI, or you've always done this in some way or shape or fashion?
I've always done this, since I was a little kid.
Okay.
Which is bizarre.
What were you starting off on with as a kid?
Pavre.
Pavre, nice.
Yeah.
So what was your 3D package?
Is this, that was it.
Oh, that's right.
Text-based.
Yeah.
There was, this was pre-Windows, pre-mouse, you know. Yeah. I was maybe 8 years old, you know. So it was like, you know, 1989, 1990, and there was nothing, you know.
Right.
And
I used Pavre in my physics class to do design optical systems for whatever we're going to do, because that actually worked.
Right. Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah. And it was just, it was hilarious. And I taught my, I had a friend whose father was a software engineer for a stock market company. I don't even really understand what it is that he did. He made some sort of, you know, financial software again in the late 80s. And so he got a hold of this Pavre thing, and his son and I were friends, and we were both, you know, really smart and smart little obnoxious kids. And he showed it to us, and we figured it out, and we just went to town and started making all this stuff. We went to the science fair because we made like a replica of some Scottish castle, like block by vertex by vertex, plotting the points in three, you know, in 3D space by hand and text, I mean, which was insane.
Yep.
And it would take 24 hours to render a single image that looked horrible. And it was really funny. And then, you know, obviously as time went on, then technology at that time especially was just turning over crazy and just kind of, you know, went with it when 3D Studio R4 came out and then finally, you know, Max and all that stuff. I started on 3D Studio.
And DOS, yeah.
Yeah, and then went to Max and didn't actually learn Maya until I graduated from college, because I failed my Maya class at RIT because my teacher was a moron. He had no idea what was going on.
Oh, that's too bad.
So I was just like, screw it, I'll just keep doing it. 3D Max is fine.
Right. Well, that's cool. And then when you went to Saab, were they actually doing a lot of 3D back then when you first started there?
Yeah, they were.
So they already had like a Maya pipeline at that point? Or?
I wouldn't say pipeline, but they had a bunch of copies of Maya.
Okay,
and, there you go. You know, wow.
Eventually it turned into a pipeline, I guess.
Yes, it did. Yeah, it did.
But you guys are fairly flexible. You guys kind of use whatever tools you need for whatever.
Yeah, we tried to be as flexible as possible. We've kind of settled into through the pipeline and kind of making of our own tools and things like that. We've kind of settled into a slightly more congruous workflow, even across the offices. But, you know, we still have to be flexible because of the nature of the work. It just changes all the time.
Right.
The asks and the styles and, you know, all of that stuff just is constantly changing. So
now, do you guys still have this, the other group? Is it Mass Market?
That shut down a couple years ago.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Which was a traditional VFX service for outside directors.
Okay.
So that was kind
so
of
you guys,
know, like a mill type of scenario, a little mini kind of finishing service.
Gotcha.
And VFX for other directors and other clients, which was ill-fated.
So this is an important distinction because what you guys do, you're not necessarily the same kind of post service, right?
No, we're all directors. Yeah, so it's all director driven.
Right.
The directors, you know, do the whole process.
So how does a job come to you? So a job comes to you, says we've got something, and you guys
pitch on it,
direct it, come up with the creative.
Yeah, and then follow the whole process all the way through, follow the production all the way through in-house.
Right, so it's not like you guys get a bunch of boards and you say, how are we going to do this? You make the boards.
Right, yeah. For the most part. I mean, it's, you know, the agency, and depending on the client, it could be more or less kind of interactive and collaborative in that sense. But in general, people, you know, usually come to us for our creative perspective. So that's always good.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always the case, but it's nice when it is.
One thing I saw and that you were talking about is that you guys don't necessarily credit specific directors mm-hmm. on things. You guys yeah. think of yourselves
as a director collective.
Director yeah. collective.
Yeah. yeah. And that's kind of slightly changed over the years because it is confusing for a lot of people, especially even for our clients in general, who may want to identify a specific person who's yeah. done a specific thing as something that they're looking for. And obviously,
or who we to know communicate who
that is. To. Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of changed a little bit over the past like a year or so, but it's very new.
Okay.
And I think that is, you know, that's interesting to kind of push individual directors in that collective as being specialized in certain things.
Do you feel that this is just, that was just confusing to some of your customers?
Or? Yeah, I think so. And I think. I don't know. And there was a conscious decision to address that. So I think that there was right. at least some sort of demonstrable kind of effect of it.
But I'm sure that, I mean, my guess is that in your DNA, you mm-hmm. guys think of the strengths that you guys have and you're going to foster on that. So you're still going to yeah. use multiple directors in a sense, but
right,
you'll
right.
have one person say, okay, I'll be the voice.
Right.
Is
exactly.
Kind of
yeah. But it's not, you know, it's not even really as interactive and collaborative as a collective would even really the word itself would belie. I mean, it's not like we're all kind of meddling in each other's things. Certainly we inspire each other and all of that, but it's not, you know, everyone isn't really on all of the jobs together. There's no real executive creative director or anything like that either, or any kind
okay.
of higher level process that oversees all of these individual
sure.
things. It's relatively autonomous and people have kind of just drifted into or attained their own specializations.
Do you feel
space.
That the work has become more diverse that way, or is there
yeah.
still an overall PSYOP feeling of things?
No, I really don't think that there is. I mean, there's things that you can see. I don't know. I don't know if it's it's identifiable as a PSYOP look. I think that all the directors kind of have different tastes, mm-hmm. certainly. And then, you know, the way that they're expressed might be similar, but they won't necessarily look the same. I don't know how to really describe it, but it's, you know, there's not a lot, unless obviously it's repeat stuff. I don't feel like a lot of our stuff looks like it even,
okay.
you know, belongs in a collection. I don't really know.
Yeah, but you guys do a lot, still are fairly busy, right? You guys have all
yeah,
grown
all the time.
A lot, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Which one is your, how between your New York and your LA office, mm-hmm. how big are you guys? Like, which one is the biggest
we
office?
We just moved
point?
Into a new space in New York,
okay.
Which has a much higher capacity, I believe. And they've always generally, I think, had more staff people mm-hmm. Than we have in Los Angeles. I don't know if that's the case still, but we have two offices in Los Angeles. I'm in one on Redwood Avenue, and then there's our original LA office space, which is
in Venice,
yeah,
okay.
in Victoria near Abbot Kinney.
Right.
And so that space can hold like 130, 140 people. My space can hold a lot of people.
Right. Do you guys have other offices around the world too, or just mainly those two offices?
Just those two offices
okay.
right now, yeah.
Yeah, but it's still really, really kind of cool. Do you feel, how do you guys get your work? What's your process? I mean, how does it?
You know, we have representatives
sure.
in the U.S. and in Europe and all over the world and Asia.
And it mainly comes from agencies, I'm assuming,
it
right?
It does. And that's just traditionally kind of where it's always kind of been derived from. But
do you
we
have
are
like
seeing,
customers, like direct product people coming
we
to you?
We do, yeah. And that has been increasing over the past couple of years,
okay.
Which is actually really interesting. And I think it's a good
yeah.
thing.
Because that puts you in a sense sort of almost competing with agencies.
It does. And that, you know,
there's
problems
that
come with that.
Yeah.
yeah. And, you know, there are agencies that you work with that, you know, are a pain in the butt, and there are agencies that you work with that you love, but they, regardless of that, they perform a function no matter what it is.
Yep.
And that function removed from this process is different than, you know, it would be otherwise. And sometimes it's different for the better and sometimes it's different for the worse.
Sure.
You've got really horrible direct to client,
right.
interactions where they're, you know, without that buffer, they're not able to accurately express the ideas that they're trying to express. And then in other instances, it's really fantastic and really, you know, there's a lot of good cooperation in there. But, you know, it really is case by case. The good thing about working in commercials is that the cases go by really quickly.
Yep.
So no matter what the case, it's the end is always in sight, which is good. As opposed to like feature films or something like that.
Yeah, I know. I used to say that. It's like, you know, sometimes like, you know, not every project you're going to work on is going to be a great one. And cool in commercials, if it's not a good one, it's okay because it'll be over in a few months. Right,
exactly.
But in feature films, it could be you're going to be on a crappy project for a year or two, and that's just a waste of.
I know. I never really wanted to do it, and I don't think I have the right temperament for extraordinarily long term work like that. You know, but we'll see.
Now you are one of the directors, I'm assuming, that's part of that group, and we'll talk a little bit about Sisters because I think that was a really cool piece.
Thank you.
But what is your general? Is it mainly just a director or director, or do you have other things? Because obviously you have a lot of technical background, and you're involved in a lot of the technical building of the company as
Right? Yeah. I mean, I used to be the head of the CG department briefly for like a year, a few years ago. That was really largely just to fill a gap that we ended up filling with a much more able person for that, which was good. And it was far too technical for a creative person to really to sustain that level of attention. So now, yes, I'm a director, but now my focus is virtual reality. And so I've kind of taken myself off of the commercial directing market to really focus on virtual reality.
Interesting.
And we're doing, you know, work for hire work in virtual reality, which I'm also directing. But the 2D, old school 2D commercials, you know, like on the old screens, you know, not to do as much of that anymore unless it's really, you know,
so is that what your new office does?
Because it's concentrated in VR,
right, because that would make sense. You need different equipment.
And AR as well.
And AR as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Let's before we get too much into the VR AR, I want to sort of talk about the Sisters piece that you did. And that sort of was a experimental piece that you were working on, and it wasn't for a specific client, right? A PSYOP?
It was not. That was a side project. It was a passion project. It actually took me about 7 or 8 years to make that film.
Wow.
What it essentially started as was a way for me to keep my artists busy when they weren't booked on projects.
Oh, cool.
So I came up with this concept and wanted to create this film, design these characters. And so if I had a new modeling intern or someone that I needed to test out, I would throw them onto the job and I would see what they could do. And, you know, and I would help direct them. And then, you know, a project would come in, 6 months would go by, and nobody has touched it. And then, you know, we'd come back to it eventually.
So it was like this thing that was just simmering in a back burner for a long time.
Yeah. And so I spent a lot of my own kind of personal time working on that in between projects and all that kind of stuff. And so it took a very, very, very long time to do. And but it was really, that's what it was about, was kind of just really keeping busy. And then it turned into this, you know, really beautiful and amazing
film. Yeah, it did.
I was
absolutely
so happy to finally be able to release it.
When did it get released? Just recently,
this year. Yeah. Right. I think it was June 1st when our music license kind of kicked in, or May 1st or something like that.
Okay.
I had actually finished it last August and had been waiting to get the licensing cleared on the music for like 8 months, 6 months or something.
Well, tell me about that a little bit, because I love Phoebe Ray. I think they're really great.
Yeah. She's fantastic.
She is fantastic. And there's really pretty much just one album.
It's it.
Mm-hmm. But I think she's been in other things as well.
Yeah,
but really
course, yeah.
great, great stuff. And they do, their actual music videos are beautiful.
Really great. Yeah. And they use a singular director. It's this one Swedish guy that they use. And he is, absolutely prolific. Yeah. I love it.
What was the one that they did that was it When I Was Young or something? Or
When I Grow Up.
When I Grow Up.
With the girl with the pool.
On the pool. And
it's so amazing.
That's an incredible.
So beautiful. Yeah.
I just I get the shivers when I think about that one.
Yeah.
But I like their music. It's really just kind of really, it's very obviously very kind of, different.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think that, from what when the minute that it started, I just saw it recently because Steve pointed to me, which was great. And so I was looked at it recently and I was like, oh, this is, I know exactly what this song is. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And then, has the right aesthetic, right? Mm-hmm. And that aesthetic that you picked was specifically goes so well with that
type
of thing. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a lot of the, obviously there must have been some influences from the Chris Cunningham video
and all that stuff. Yeah. Tons of it. Because I grew up on all that. So, I just absolutely loved it. That, those... And that era too, there were some just amazing music videos in that time that were really, that was a huge inspiration to me.
When I was sort of getting into CG more professionally or creatively in this one, because my CG background was much more practical. It was all about the architecture side of things for a long time for my math background and visualizing math. But when I was sort of getting creative and I was starting seeing all those remember those stacks of DVDs that came out that it was like the Chris Cunningham and the who else what's the guy
Michel Gondry
and all those things
exactly and Spike Jones exactly.
They were really great and I was like I started saying there is something about that and that's what I kind of liked about Sisters is it sort of took me back to that era of creative
that's great
nice feeling where it's like I see something that. And, it goes back to what you were just talking about, the perception. Like your mind is – you're tying the music and the video are putting things together in a very specific way. Like I just – even just the idea of the lights flashing as the beat is happening.
Sure.
And it sort of creates – it enhances that beat. Like your beat, you kind of not necessarily notice suddenly becomes much more in your face.
Yeah, and that was actually I don't know if you've ever seen Fever Ray live. That's actually part of her show. I first saw her, and I get goosebumps when I think about this. It's just amazing. I actually think first saw her live. It was at Coachella. It was years and years ago.
Oh, okay.
When the album had just first come out, and I knew who she was, and I had heard the album, and none of my friends who I was with knew. And I was like, "You have to come and see this. I guarantee you, it's going to be the most amazing thing ever." And the show started in complete pitch blackness with these two green laser beams. Mm-hmm. And then there was a bunch of house lamps just scattered around the stage that were all timed to the beat. And so it just, the show started in this complete darkness and then the lights go up and the costumes and all of this stuff. And I was just absolutely beside myself.
Yeah, I bet.
I couldn't believe it. It was amazing. And so that, some of that is inspired from her live show, which is just great.
So part of the other thing that you have a real passion, obviously, for your sort of costume design and character design. Character work is very big for you, right?
Yeah.
And so how did you design all these characters and have them all, so how did that?
I did a lot of the modeling I did half of the modeling for the characters as well in the environment.
Yeah.
But I love that it's really most of the work that I do is really just an excuse to design these characters really.
Nice.
And most of the time really the characters come first. I'll see the way that they look and then we can come up with a story for them after the fact, but it's usually as a design first thing, which is really interesting.
That makes sense. And they also must, they're pretty complicated as an animation asset too. There's a lot of rigging.
Very, very complicated. Yeah.
So did you do a lot of that work as well?
No. I have. Yeah. Luckily, have world class riggers at my disposal.
Okay.
And also, fantastic character animators. I am the absolute worst character animator in the whole world. Always have been.
Yep.
My specialty has always been texturing, lighting, rendering, and compositing. So.
Right. And yeah. I saw it in the credits that you did. Obviously, did a lot of lighting, and you like. Yeah. Did you do compositing as well?
Or you had some there was compositing? No compositing.
Oh, really?
That's all one beauty layer. Yeah. So it's just color correction. Wow. So I yeah.
There you go. Well, no, that's not uncommon these days. I mean, renderers are very, very capable of doing that.
And I hate to say it, but it was Arnold.
I'm sure it was. Yeah, no. Of course it was, because you guys use a lot of Arnold over there. But it is true. That, like, a lot of compositing right now, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's funny because I talked to some of our studios mm-hmm. that are now that they've always done and do incredible work, and they're mm-hmm. and there's like, we're starting to try this new thing called compositing. You realize you can actually render things in layers.
Right.
Like, yeah, you can.
Yeah.
But there is a beauty to the fact that when you mm-hmm. do all of it in camera, mm-hmm. then it's much more optical.
Right? Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So, and that's the way that we built the whole thing, was that we didn't really previs the shots. The sure. camera, we prevised their performance, and then
did you do motion capture?
No, we didn't. We shot reference. It was choreographed by a friend of mine, and we shot some reference, but
because I don't
it was
think
all
it,
hand animated.
It can't be, because they look like puppets,
exactly,
and they have to look like puppets. You can't they really do. Motion. Yeah. It would look
too human. We thought that would be the wrong thing to do.
They have to have a mechanical feel mm-hmm. to them, except for the lips, right? The lips,
right? Which is interesting. And there's some a little bit of stutter in there, and every once in a while, but yeah. And that was the balance that we wanted, was very subtle human quality with an overwhelming kind of mechanical complexity.
Yeah, there's almost a little bit of a Leica feel to it in a sense.
That's good.
So okay, it's like I'll a little Coraline-y. And a little, right. Yeah, no, it's really great. There's a lot of blends and stuff. I think mm-hmm. it's a fantastic package.
Thank you.
Really, really cool.
I appreciate that.
All right, I'd like to get into the VR stuff.
Sure.
Sort of talk about first of all, how did you guys get into VR? Obviously, a lot of people these days are doing it, but what got you guys into it?
It was me. I'm obsessed. And this is another one of those childhood things that, you know, in the 90s, we were kind of promised VR in a way that we were promised hover skateboards and all these things. Mm-hmm. But VR seemed like it would have been attainable at that point. Clearly, in hindsight, it would not have been. There's no way that could have ever really worked in a meaningful way.
Sure.
Until, you know, the technology sizing, you know. Worked out, but I was immediately caught by the concept of it, because the reason why I enjoy animation, the reason why I enjoy video games and all of these things as much as I do, is because of this overwhelming sense of escapism. Mm-hmm. And that really the ability to transport yourself to another place in an actual manner now, mm-hmm. and combined with the ability that I can actually create these environments myself, was just an overwhelming concept to me. Even at that age, I understood what the implications of that were and where this was eventually going to go. And then it kind of vanished for a long time, for 20 years. And no one really ever heard anything about it again until the Oculus.
Right.
And so I remember hearing about
it. The Oculus Revolution.
Yeah, exactly. And thank goodness that it happened. And it, you know, I remember hearing about it and seeing the Kickstarter thing and thinking, okay, well, that's cool, but I don't really know, you know, I don't really believe it, you know. And then I had a friend who had one, who got one. And
The first one, the DK1.
And they're my friends who are part of Marshmallow Laser Feast. They're a... this group of crazy guys that do the amazing interactive installations. They're doing a bunch of really cool virtual reality stuff now. They did In the Eyes of the Animal, which is the laser scanned forest thing. I don't know if you've heard about that. It's really cool. They're brilliant. And so they brought a set of goggles and a little demo that they had made that was just so simple, particle systems and some vector fluid vector fields. And I put those goggles on and rolled around on the floor like a maniac for about an hour and a half, just like looking at this world and experiencing the tracking and the stereo and all this stuff. And I just could not believe it. I couldn't believe it that even, again, that simple demonstration of it, I was like, this is it. It's actually happening. And it became my immediate focus.
Right.
And I because I realized that, okay, here I am at this point in my career where I'm able to, you know, I have access to an incredible amount of resources to actually do this type of work.
Yep.
The only thing that I'm really missing is the development kind of knowledge and whatever that's relatively easily found. And so I thought, I'm in the right place at the right time. I need to jump on this so that sure. I can be a part of it for the long term.
Yeah.
And then ever since then, it's just been pedal to the metal on the VR side.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious as to what kind of projects you guys are doing, because I think mm-hmm. a lot of people are sure. doing different things, and I'm mm-hmm. just sort of wondering, what is the types of projects that you guys work on?
Sure. So we are, so we do all the Clash of Clans TV commercials,
oh, okay.
you
yeah.
know, like all the bunch of great character animation stuff. And last year, I made them a little prototype of what Clash of Clans would look like in VR in mm-hmm. real time. Just a really simple kind of test, and showed it to the clients when they were in town. They were like, this is interesting. Mm-hmm. And from that,
Was it done in real time?
That was done in real time. Yeah. It wasn't animated. It was static characters in a static environment.
Mm-hmm. You guys did it in Unity or Unreal?
We just did it in Unreal, just threw it together really okay. quick with the assets that we had from,
sure.
from the thing. And they were super interested in it and wanted to talk about what we could do in that space, and we ended up doing a 360 pre-rendered 360 stereo mm-hmm. Piece for their Clash Con that they did last year,
mm-hmm.
Which was hugely successful on YouTube as a 360 video, and was also very successful as a VR video at the event, and mm-hmm. And that, even just that 360 video, I think it got like 39 million views within
wow.
like the first couple of days. Of Clash of Clans audience is a rabid consumer of content, which is fantastic.
Uh-huh.
And so that inspired not just them, but also other clients to kind of engage in this 360,
yes.
you know, platform for advertising. And so we've done a handful of things like that for a variety of different clients. What we're interested in doing more of is doing, you know, actually interactive, like what does an interactive VR ad look like?
Mm-hmm.
What is a VR ad, you know, eventually?
Yeah, what is a VR ad?
Well, and so what I think it will be, I don't think it's really quite anything yet, but imagine very soon we'll be seeing live streamed events in VR, you know, like
okay.
sports and concerts and the Olympics. I'm sure the next time the Olympics rolls around, and even Oculus is doing a lot of coverage in 360 video mm-hmm. there now, you can imagine live streaming you know, these events, or maybe there's a television, a VR series, an episodic series that mm-hmm. people watch perpetually. And so what happens when there's a commercial break, but you're already in VR? So does that sure. mean that there are now, you know, VR actual interactive commercials that appear in between different things?
Sure.
Is that, you know what I mean? Is that a necessity at all? Is it, you know, is it only for non-paid content, or, and what does that look like? And there might be a market for that in the future.
Do you really think that there's, I mean, the sports thing makes sense to me. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, I'm actually
yeah,
in the
yeah,
arena,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering really about telling narrative in VR.
Sure.
And
sure.
what do you feel some of those challenges are? Because I'm
oh,
sure
God,
since
yeah.
you're making VR content, you're making
yeah.
stuff all the time.
Yeah.
How do you tell stories in VR?
It's very difficult. And I don't think that a lot of the stuff that's happening right now is really any different than what we're normally used to. It's just a wider perspective, right? So there's things that are happening.
Yeah. And do you think that's appropriate?
No. No, I don't. I really don't.
Yeah.
And nor do I really think the 360 video or pre-rendered content in that capacity is really going to be effective for very much longer either.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
And so I really believe that it's interactive entertainment, which essentially is the gap in between what makes a great video game and what makes a great film or television series. Mm-hmm. And it's what is in between that is what VR is meant to be.
Okay.
And no, I don't know what that really is yet. You know, when you think about interactive movies, you think about stuff like Dragon's Lair or,
right,
you know, these kind of horrible permutations of existing content. I mean, I don't think it's that either. Yeah. Right. You know, I think that there's, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, essentially, is what the answer to that question is.
Right.
Because eventually someone will figure it out.
Right.
If you think about the App Store, when it first started for mobile phones, there was nothing but garbage. And there were, you know, I was just overloaded with all these terrible games, all of these terrible applications that didn't really work properly.
Right.
And within 5 years, there's now like a relative standard of quality and of craftsmanship for those types of things that just required some time in the oven to kind of figure it out, and required exploration and experimentation to achieve a result that is now, you know, relatively straightforward to know whether or not you're making a crappy app or a good app.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some fundamental things. I think what you're doing, you said, is correct. Is that a lot of the you know, I have a feeling that a lot of the agencies, and this is not content creators like you are aware of the limitations, but a lot of people's like, I just want some of that VR stuff. Can you give me some of that VR-ness?
Oh, yes.
And there's
I actually got a slideshow once that just really had one slide, and it just said that, you know, like, choose your own adventure in VR. And you're like, that's not an idea.
No, right. And so it's like, no, because the thing, choose your own adventure is almost, because sometimes people are just like, I'm just going to do the same thing I've always done.
Right. Yeah,
I'm just going to put a 360.
Choose your own adventure would be better in that scenario.
Yeah, because you're making choices.
Right.
Because in other ones, you're not necessarily making choices. You're just present. And sometimes the thing about VR is that you really are present.
Yeah.
And so when something's happening around you and you're just sort of there, it feels awkward.
Yeah,
you
that's
know?
True. Yeah.
And so I think that sometimes that doesn't always work. But
yeah.
And I think that the, you know, I'm sure you'd agree. It's like the traditional content I see on TV is a third-person experience.
Yeah.
You are an observer observing a story like a play or whatever else. This is a traditional way you've done it. And VR is actually a first-person experience.
Yes, yes.
And so,
and it's very interesting. And figuring out how that works, and you have to give yourself a reason to be there.
Right.
You have to, you know, have the environment respond to your presence in an acceptable way. You have to make sure that the viewer is comfortable. There's all these crazy limitations, and it's really all about, you know, bringing the viewer into this environment.
Mm-hmm.
And what seems to not really be happening is involving the user in the story, or involving the user in a really, you know, really well-connected way to the whole experience, which I think, you know, again, it's just a matter of time. And right now, you know, there's so little content really still. It's just kind of dripping out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the good stuff is still in the works, or it's just being started right now, you know, because everybody's learning from the first wave of all of these things. And now we'll hopefully be able to apply those lessons learned to the next things that we all make.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I think that's happening on multiple levels. But
yeah.
I'm wondering, okay, so what we're basically describing is a creative challenge that we haven't quite figured out how to the creativity of VR yet, or the language of what that creativity is. What about the technology? Where do you think the limitations are right now, and where do you want it to be?
Oh, God. Well, the limitations right now are surprisingly few, depending on the platform, obviously. But you know, the limitations aren't that big of a deal, because you can clearly see that the limitations will be extraordinarily short-lived. The graphics cards that are coming out just, you know, twice a year now are just out of control. And we're just, you know, they've got them scattered all over the office.
yes, we do too,
you know, because we're constantly swapping them out and putting new ones in. I'm not really worried about that. I think that because I think that VR will eventually explode in a meaningful way in terms of consumer adoption, that the graphics card industry will continue to grow even further.
Sure.
And so it will catch up faster then console gaming has tried to catch up to PC quality gaming, which still hasn't done, but is inching ever closer. It's taken a really long time for those curves to kind of meet. I don't think it's going to be the same kind of wait time for the VR stuff, because I think hopefully the demand will kind of will spark that production.
But, you know, it was interesting because, and I said it, I had my kids in the other day, and they were looking at stuff, and I was saying, oh yeah, you guys should check out the IKEA thing on Vive, right?
Yeah.
And my son, 6 and a half, I said, this is like, and we were just chatting. He's like, oh, it was so much fun. I did this and that. And I said, did it feel like you were in an IKEA kitchen? And he very honestly, because there's no filter on that kid,
right?
Yeah, he goes to me and goes, no, because I could see like the dots that you see on a TV. Right. He said it right away.
Right.
Like,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Like, and he says, no, that's not real. I could see the dots.
Right, right.
And he's like, and that's a Vive. That's a good display. Right, which is
it's a great display. Yeah, and so like, that's amazing.
Okay, all right. So you see the dots. And I'm thinking, he's like, all right, unless he sees like what we were just describing at the beginning of the podcast, the way your eyes really look, to him, it's not real.
Yeah, right.
He
right.
loves it. He likes the enjoyment. He feels it, but it's not real.
Sure.
And that's fine.
And that to me is fine because what I'm mostly interested in, again, you know, from this animation perspective, I'm not interested in real. Like, I understand that the artifice of that, like identifying that the experience is fake, but the reality of it to me, I think it's far more interesting for it not to be realistic. And this is a totally separate thing, but. Yeah, just spawned that thought.
Yeah, no, it's a good. You're right. I mean, does it have?
Like,
to be
I wouldn't real? Want to do a VR experience of being in an IKEA kitchen. I wouldn't want to be in an IKEA kitchen to start with in the real world.
I know,
why would I want to do that? Which is just, you know, it's a separate topic. But
I think that there's a lot of things that are useful. I mean, to be honest, like it's not. No, it's not 100% real, but it definitely serves the purpose of showing you what it could be.
Sure.
You know, from the our architect's client's point of view, it's like, this is way better than a rendering.
Totally.
You know?
Well, and then the HoloLens, too, for that specific thing, which I think is interesting in a realistic capacity because it's overlaid on top of actual reality.
Oh, absolutely,
And specifically for architecture, I think it's really kind of striking opportunity. Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm super, very, very, very interested in AR as well.
Yeah, and that, you know, what's cool about the AR thing is if they solve the tracking, which like HoloLens
just
is
just remarkable.
I don't know how they're
doing
it.
It's so good.
Because it's just there's nothing else. That's the other thing. Okay.
Right, the wireless
thing. There's wireless,
right? Yeah.
They're doing it without wires, and I think that's another thing. That's amazing. I think Intel just did an announcement that they're working on a wireless headset.
Yeah, that's going to be a big problem for everyone to solve because it is a hindrance, and it does. Right. You feel that cable brush against you, and you're pulled out immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, or you step on it or you're worried about it and you know, disables you from immersing yourself in it.
Yeah. And where do you see VR in the living room? You know what I mean? Do you see VR in the living room?
I do. And I think that it will be the PlayStation VR that really kind of does that.
Yep.
And I think that will
That's not commercial yet, right?
No, October 14th. So, Kismet will be a launch title on PlayStation VR, which is great. And I think that, again, there's, you know, what, 40 million PlayStations in the wild. You know, if there's ever was a chance at a wider adoption rate, it's going to be with that.
Right.
And the technology is, you know, again, it's behind in terms of the Oculus and the Vive and the tracking and the resolution and the processing and all of that stuff. But, you know, as a relatively low cost kind of introductory experience, it's still very good, very good, surprisingly good even.
I think that's true because, but if you look at that situation, right, the person's not going to be running around in their living room because they're going to be bumping into a bunch of stuff.
No,
right?
Exactly. Right.
So they have the ability to look around, which is incredible. Just, you know, just the ability to look around is a really amazing experience,
sure.
Right?
But it's definitely not room scale. It's not the void, you know, and
just practically speaking, it can't be room scale.
No.
You have pretty good range.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it does have pretty good range in terms of like, you know, it's about Wii range, you know, sure. So you have like about 4, you know, square feet around your body to kind of move around and stand up and sit down and, all of those things. So it's, you know, but it is a challenge. It's just locomotion in VR in general is a challenge, beyond a, you know, large scale actual installation.
Right.
It's very difficult, you know, to do that. So,
yeah, I find it really, really interesting. And I also think that, you know, it's also a very personal experience, right? Because I think that that's the thing I think that's going to distinguish VR and AR is also some of the things that
it's true.
When you just know when you go to some conference, right, and it's some VR thing, there's a huge line.
It's true.
And the reason there's a huge line is not necessarily because it's a great VR experience. It's because only one person at a time can see this thing.
I know. I know. It's really interesting. And the opportunity for, you know, live, local, multiplayer AR experiences is really kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, and I think what Google's doing and all this, there's going to be some interesting developments, you know, and combinations of the two, switching between AR and VR in some kind of way. And
what are you most looking forward to?
The next wave of content and hardware.
So you want to see what happens at that 5-year mark or whatever, right?
I think even, you know, at the end of next year, we'll probably start to see some movement, from the platforms. You know, I think the consoles are being upgraded soon, which is always an interesting thing, that happens. You know, I don't know. I think it's been interesting to see what's happened so far, and not a lot has happened, and most of the stuff that's kind of happening in VR isn't particularly what I would think is great VR. You know,
you think they're
mostly
just tech demos?
Mostly tech demos still, and then games that are maybe interesting, that have interesting parts to them, but as a whole aren't really, you know, a satisfying experience. There's nothing really that I feel like I want to go back to over and over again and do a bunch of different times. You know, other than Tilt Brush, you know, which is interesting. And so, you know, I think it's really just about broadening the content and broadening the audience, and figuring it all out together, you know, and people will start to identify what their tastes are. I'm hoping that once content comes out that's not just a port of a regular game into VR, that people will embrace it. Okay. I'm not sure that that's the case. You know, we won't know because we don't even know what that content is yet. But I'd like to believe that, you know, we can figure it out, you know, or at least be a part of figuring it out.
What do you think is going to be necessary for that problem to be solved?
Money and time. And mostly time, which is hard. I mean, you look at, you know, not that I ever will claim to be able to make a AAA game, but you look at some of these AAA games that take years and years and years to accomplish. Right. It's longer than feature films with budgets that are similar, if not higher, than feature films. You know, the next great VR content that's being worked on right now might not be out for 3 years, know, and we won't know what that is until at least a year and a half from now.
Right.
And so it's interesting. And really what I'm trying to do is just make as much stuff as I possibly can, right now.
Do you
now
think that games is the right avenue to?
Well, I think that games, it's tricky because even the categorization of VR right now is kind of ridiculous and arbitrary.
Okay.
You know, because I don't think, you know, there's mostly games that are being made, and that the like kind of in between categories haven't really been very well defined. There's a lot of like VR short films that are, again, not interactive in any capacity whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You're just a passive observer in a 3-dimensional environment, which I find, you know, completely absurd. And so I think that there's a level of gamification that's required to even reach the interest of the population that is interested in VR right now. And hopefully we can, you know, make a gamified narrative that is still kind of artful in its own right, and that is interesting enough to attract some attention, but, you know, doesn't have a gun or a zombie in it. You know what I mean? I would love that.
Sounds like you're agreeing with me, but like BioShock Infinite, have you played the game?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It's a fantastic game.
Sure.
I actually didn't like to have to shoot things to get to the next part. I actually wanted to see the story. The story was very first person, right?
Sure, yeah.
Because you're following this girl around like, oh my God. And that is, that could see that as a VR story.
100%. Yeah, yeah, totally.
You know, where you're traveling and you're following this beautiful story.
Right, exactly. And that's the kind of content that I'm most interested in. Games like Journey, games like Shadow of the Colossus that are, you know, these really kind of fantastic storyline first, still amazing gameplay.
Yeah.
But there's a clarity to the story. Even Inside just came out recently from the guys that made Limbo, which is just spectacularly horrifying and dark and bitter.
Is it a mobile game?
No, it's on Steam now. Okay. It's on PC and it'll be out on the 23rd for PlayStation, August 23rd.
Okay.
And it's just a remarkably bizarre, fantastic story. Not a word is spoken the entire time. Yeah. I just love it to pieces.
That sounds awesome.
So that kind of content to me in VR would also be really interesting. Yeah. Even as a linear kind of storyline, I don't know. And so those are the types of things that I am really most passionate about and I'm actively working on.
But it sounds like you guys have to do a whole, it's not just, you know, adapting your old process and doing this. You're going to have to develop everything new, right? Yeah,
new stuff.
You guys must be spending a lot of time in Unreal or...
Yeah, yeah. You know, and we have a small development team that we're, you know, growing and that is, you know, really figuring it out as we go along with everybody else. You know, we have a little bit of a head start because we've been doing this for a hot minute, but not too much longer than anybody else. And again, we're not a game studio, you know, so we're approaching these things differently. And but it's interesting, you know, and it's not impossible. And really, I think what we're able to leverage, which is all of our amazing animation capabilities and asset creation resources and all that kind of stuff, outweighs the difficulty of the development by a long shot. Because most video game developers have a lot of smart programmers and maybe not a lot of super creative, hypercritical people floating around, because you can... Most games, you know, especially in VR, have big pieces missing, you know, like the animation is horrifically terrible or the design is completely vapid, but the game mechanics are really cool or it's the opposite or whatever, you know, it's like concentrating all of your efforts into one specific area and not really having an overview that is solid.
I agree. I mean, yeah. I've been actually, I've been doing this talk with a bunch of our architecture clients because that's my back when I was an architect years ago. And I was saying, you know, the problem with VR is that it's unbelievably ugly right now.
Yeah.
And because a lot of people are making stuff, but they have no, it's just terrible. And architects, that's their job, is to design environments.
Right.
And so it's like, save us from, this is a new real estate space for you. Go ahead, build new architecture inside of VR and make that something that you can look at. I'm sure you're studying your design and art background is obviously hugely influencing trying to make a more beautiful space. To live in,
right, of course, yeah. And that's, you know, and it's interesting, there's a lot more consideration to it than just designing even a regular two-dimensional kind of representation of a space and all of that. So it's very interesting, but it's very rewardingly challenging, you know. I love it, actually.
That's cool. Yeah. Well, can you plug anything that we can look forward to seeing that's going to be coming out, or is there stuff that we can see in VR that you guys have created?
Yeah, so Kismet is my first VR experience that I created. It's available on the Oculus Store and the HTC Vive and the Steam Store, rather. And it will be available on PlayStation in October.
Awesome.
And so Kismet is a virtual reality fortune-telling machine. And so she resides in a gypsy wagon. It's a seated experience. And she resides in this magical gypsy wagon and can give you a 3-card past, present, future tarot card reading, a daily horoscope reading. It's based on your birthday with your zodiac sign. You can also play a board game with her. And so she's this character that's not real, and you interact with her in this very interesting way, and it's just a very detailed and beautiful environments that you travel through. And there's a great kind of, it's really is a great introductory experience for people to try out as their first VR thing. It's very comfortable.
Right.
The interactivity is very kind of low impact. And people have reported it to be satisfying in a variety of interesting ways, from it being calming to the tarot card readings being creepily accurate, right, and like all of these things. It's been a really fun process to,
that's cool,
to see. That
how long you guys worked on that?
I started designing it about a year and a half ago, and writing it and designing the character and the environments and just thinking about, you know, how it could be a good VR experience, and then pitched it internally to PSYOP at the end of last year in December, and then started production right after that, and finished it at the beginning of May of this year. So it's been available. It's like $6.99, I think, on the store. You can catch it on sale sometimes, and it's really cool. It's definitely worth a look, you know. And it's I love it. I think it's really interesting. And again, it was a very good kind of first toe in the water for us to identify that, yes, we are capable of doing this. We're thinking about it in an interesting way. Hopefully we'll be able to continue doing that for a long time. That'd be fun.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. I'll definitely go make sure we can put links up there so people can check it out.
Oh, cool. Great.
That'd be fun. I want to make sure that people do that. Yeah, it's really cool. I think it's really great to see these different experiences. We see so many different ideas that's going on there. And I'd love to do any kind of things like that. That's a great idea, fortune telling.
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, the target audience is totally wrong. You know, the early adopters of VR are not people who seemingly are interested in astrology or tarot card reading. But again, it was a natural kind of a natural idea to fit in that space that kind of ticked all the right boxes and was visually interesting. And we learned so much from it. And it was such a great process that that's where about its value certainly lies.
That sounds great.
And its sale value, but.
Well, cool.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dave. We're wrapping down towards the end. I'm sure put people up, links on both. I guess we'll sisters up as well.
Sure. That'd be great. That.
And then we'll let people know about Kismet and put links on that.
Awesome.
That sounds good. Thanks so much.
Thank you.